we'll need four. Mm-hmm. So,
so if you want a public hearing on the DCDS, but we could do that right now.
Can I do this one first? Do we have to suspend the rules on that one?
Let me double check.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is May 30th. We're almost to June. I can't believe it. Can hardly wait. I'm going to sort of move around here. Some bills, I'm going to need four people here, and I know that they're coming. So I'm going to just start out, since I know a number of you are here for 2303A. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2303.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2303, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The bill received a public hearing on May 16th. The bill changes coordinated care organizations' reporting date to the Oregon Health Authority from December 31st to October 1st each year, deletes statutory references to a community-based health care initiative, specifies that in addition to the Oregon Health Authority director, a designee of the director can be appointed as a member to the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing Information, updates statutory language, deletes references of Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. There is a dash 3 A amendment posted to OLIS.
Okay. We're in work session, and I do not plan to move the dash 3s, but I would like Senator Steiner Hayward to talk about what that amendment would say.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Or does say.
There's been a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about this amendment, and I'm disappointed, but I want to that we're not moving this forward because I think it's an important one. The amendment was intended entirely to both protect honorable practitioners and have the state have the opportunity to identify who's out there doing what and protect consumers from unscrupulous people. The vast majority of hypnotherapists, marriage, life coaches, wellness coaches, parenting coaches are really honorable people trying hard to do the best thing for the people of Oregon with their training. Same thing with QMHPs and QMHAs. It was simply an attempt to start to get our hands around who's out there doing what. This bill was a registry bill only. I want to be crystal clear about that. It was not a licensure bill. Furthermore, it would not have applied to anybody who was already licensed by another board in Oregon. And finally, it would not have required, as some people are alleging, that alternative practitioners such as hypnotherapists or wellness coaches be affiliated with any other kind of institution. So the two things that are crystal clear that this would not have done is it is not a licensure bill, and it would not have required anybody to change their practice except to register. So while I'm disappointed this isn't moving forward, I still thought it was important, and I'm grateful to Chair Mona Sanderson for allowing me to get that on the record, because I'm not quite sure where all the confusion and misunderstanding came from, but the amendment is very clear. It's a registry bill only. It doesn't change anything in practice. It's not moving forward, but I hope to continue to work on this issue during session to continue to protect well-qualified professionals from a few people who are giving professions a bad name. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, we have the underlying bill, 2303A, that...
Sorry.
Can we...
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2303A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 2303A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And remember, it is the underlying bill. There's no amendment. The dash 3 is added to it. Any more discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Breyer.
Excused.
Senator
Cano.
Excuse. Sorry.
If you excuse me, you don't have a
phone. I don't
see
you. Senator Steiner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excused.
Chairman
Sanders. Okay. Aye. Motion carries. And does anyone want to carry this bill? I will carry the bill. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2303. And then is this should this one be the next one to go then? We haven't. Okay. So I am now going to open a work session on House Bill 2754. And we are looking at the dash 3 amendments, correct? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2754. The committee held a work session last week on this bill. It requires newborn children with hearing loss to be referred to a health care provider to be tested for congenital cytomegalovirus, or CMV. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to educate health care professionals and diagnostic testing facilities through print materials on congenital CMV, including signs, symptoms, and treatment options. There's a dash 3 and a dash 4 amendment on OLIS. The dash 3 requires educational information relating to congenital CMV to be distributed each time a child fails a hearing test, whether at a hospital, birthing center, or a diagnostic facility, and whether following the first test required by law or the second test also required by law. Requires OCHA to disseminate information about CMV in addition to at the time of failing a hearing test. And requires OHA to develop a schedule by rule or otherwise under which hearing test referrals and CME testing will occur within 21 days. The schedules will be distributed to hospitals, birthing centers, and diagnostic facilities. There's a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
Okay, and the proponents of the bill, as well as OHSU, are fine with the dash 3 amendments. There are nods.
Discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a really important bill, and I think getting more attention out about congenital CMV is really important in general, and I thank the advocates for bringing this bill forward. I would point out a couple of things. First of all, there is a lot of congenital deafness that is not caused by CMV, so it's going to be important to make sure that we educate parents that there are a lot of other reasons as well. Second of all, there's a lot of congenital CMV that doesn't present with deafness, so we have to be sure that we're educating people who care for newborn babies to look for other signs and symptoms of CMV. And third, in general, I think we just have to be thoughtful about how we evaluate this. We know that some babies fail their newborn hearing test because they still have fluid in their ears or whatever from the birth process. So we need to be sure that they have adequate testing and all that kind of stuff to make sure that they aren't inappropriately diagnosed. So I think this is a really important bill. It gets attention on an important subject matter. I just want to make sure that we're clear about what it does and doesn't do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we have the
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment into House Bill 2754. Dated 5/26/17.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 3 amendments dated 5/26/17 into House Bill 2754. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted. The main bill is on the floor.
Oh, yes, it is. Okay. Just give me a minute. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2754 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2754 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Did we already do that one?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
I just stepped in.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill?
I'll take it.
Senator Steiner-Hayward will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2754, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2339.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2339A, brought to you by DCPS, prohibits non-participating facility-based providers and providers in emergency cases from balanced billing. There is a dash A11 on OLIS. DCPS Director walked through that amendment.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The dash A11 amendment represents the agreement amongst stakeholders that I described to you last week. Basically, it's a prohibition on balanced billing that takes effect in March with a work group to be convened by us between now and the end of the year to make recommendations to the February short session. I would like to note the work group really would be about the kind of balanced billing that it's described in Section 2.2 of the bill, not any kind of broader balance billing sort of an arrangement. Also, we will, by rulemaking, deal with the issue of making sure that it's clear that if you voluntarily go to an out-of-network provider at a facility, that that's not the kind of a circumstance that's covered by this bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
No. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of passing House Bill 2339 without the appropriate paperwork.
Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules so that we may pass this bill out of committee without the fiscal or the revenue. Is there any discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, just for those who may not be familiar, the fiscal and revenue is going to be basically zero, so it's just a matter of procedure.
Okay. Any other discussion? Is there any objection to the suspending the rules. Okay. Is there any objection to suspending the rules? All right. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -A11 amendment dated 5/26/17 into House Bill 2339A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A11 amendments dated 5/26/17 into House Bill 2339. Is there any discussion?
Go ahead. I'll discuss the main bill.
Clerk will call the roll.
This is just the
Is there any objection? All right. The amendment's adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2339A as amended by the -A11 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2339 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Mr. Allen and his team for really yeoman's work trying to find a path forward for this important legislation. And while I'm a little disappointed the underlying bill isn't passing, I think this is an elegant solution moving forward that will address a variety of needs. So I really want to put on the record that Mr. Allen and his team done some remarkable work on this bill.
Any other discussion? Where am I now?
Call the roll.
Oh, yeah. Clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Senator
Pell?
Aye.
Senator
Cruz?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Yes. Chair Monsanto? Aye. Motion carries. And is there someone that would like to carry the bill? Yes, Senator Cruz will carry the bill. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2339 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2342.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2342, brought to you by DCBS, permits DCBS, upon recommendation of the Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Committee, to adopt rules that are not in compliance with state law governing health insurance if specified conditions are met. There's a -A5. It's on OLIS, and it simply adds restrictions on the provisions DCBS can waive and adds essential health benefits as a provision.
Thank you, Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. House Bill 2342 is essentially what I would describe as a safety valve. It's a bill that allows us for a limited period of time to engage in a rulemaking that itself has limits that allow us to respond to unanticipated and relatively sudden changes in federal law, whether through a court decision, an administrative action, or less likely congressional action. That wasn't funny in the way I intended it to be.
Yeah, but it was in the way we took it. So.
The bill has significant sideboards, and the idea is to make sure that we really are facing, honestly, some kind of a crisis that destabilizes the insurance market in whole or in part in Oregon. And so we would need to make a finding that that whatever change has occurred at the federal level would actually endanger the health and well-being of Oregonians. We would have to have action taken by the Marketplace Advisory Committee that you created when we inherited the functions of Cover Oregon. We would only be able to engage in one rulemaking period of 6 months. Anything that needed to last longer than that would need to come to you for legislative ratification in some kind of a bill. -5 amendments further narrow that in terms of some important protections that fall outside the insurance code around civil rights and those kinds of issues. The idea, simply put, is that if something changes drastically specifically at the federal level we can respond. I give you one simple example. We're going to have some counties in Oregon this year that may have only one or two insurance carriers offering policies in the county. And if something were to change in the federal landscape that were to cause those carriers to pull out of a county so that we didn't have any carriers today, under current law, I wouldn't, even if I had a willing carrier that was willing to step into those counties, I wouldn't have any legal authority to be able to do that mid-year. So this would allow us to be able to take that kind of an action. You might ask, well, why not just have a bill that does that? And the challenge is we really can't foresee the kinds of changes that may occur at the federal level and try to anticipate all of them in a bill of this sort. And so this is the idea of this short-term kind of a safety valve. It expires after 2 years, and so that should be plenty of time to actually let the federal landscape stabilize, and then we'd be able to move forward on back on the current basis. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
And the Dash 5s are needed?
The Dash 5 amendments are an agreement with some patients' rights stakeholders around limiting the nature of what kinds of plan changes could we make with this authority.
Okay. We're in public hearing, so any questions, discussion?
If I may, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Thank you. I have been part of a group, as you have, working with DCBS and others to think about how to structure this bill. We are all dealing with enormous amounts of uncertainty right now, especially in the health arena. And I think it's very important for the citizens of Oregon and for the employers of Oregon to have some confidence that our insurance market will be as stable as possible in the face of a highly unpredictable set of changes that may occur at the federal level. So I really strongly support this bill. I think it's very well structured. I think there are really strong sideboards in place. I have real confidence in Mr. Allen and his team to implement it appropriately should we need to. But we need this bill badly, Madam Chair, to make sure that we have the safeguards in place for Oregonians should the federal government make substantial changes mid-year.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, even if the federal government doesn't make changes, nationwide there have been a lot of counties who are without insurance carriers at this point in time. So even under the current structure, it's a possibility that we need to be cognizant of, and I do support this bill.
So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2342A and open a work session on House Bill 2342A.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash A5 amendment dated 5-30-17 into House Bill 2342A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A5 amendment stated 5-30-17 into House Bill 2342. Is there any discussion? We just got the paperwork, so that's why we don't have to suspend the rules. So we do have the paper. And no further discussion. Any objection? They're adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2342A as amended by the A5 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2342A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Motion carries, and will you carry the bill then?
Okay.
All right, Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2342A. And open a work session on House Bill 2882A. Oliver.
Madam Chair, Members of the Committee, before you is House Bill 2882A. The bill received a public hearing on May 11th. The bill requires a coordinated care organization governing body to include a representative from at least one dental care organization that serves members of that CCO. There's a dash A6 on OLIS. The A6 removes the nomination process. We do have the paperwork. There's a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact with the dash A6. There's also from Legislative Council a brief memo defining dental care organization, because that was a question that came up during the public hearing. So we have that on OLIS as well.
All right. And did you describe what the A6s do? Does everyone understand?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A6 amendments amendment dated 5/30/17 into House Bill 2882A.
Senator Cruz moves the A6 amendment into dated 5/30/17 into House Bill 2882A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2882A as amended by the A6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2882A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator
Hill. Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Byer?
Sure.
Unless Senator Girard, does he want to carry this bill? I always give him the...
He does not want to carry this bill.
All right. Then Senator Byer will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2882A. And... This one's ready to go.
We did that.
That's right. Okay, so we can't do that one yet. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2103.
Sorry, 1 second. Got to get the paperwork. All right. Madam Chair, House Bill 2103. Receive a public hearing, and it permits licensed nurse practitioners to perform vasectomies. We have the paperwork if the committee so chooses to move the bill.
Okay.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be on the record, the discussion we had, and I know people have raised it, is that even though all nurse practitioners would be allowed to perform the service, they could only do it to the extent that they'd had the appropriate training and been certified by whatever professional organization does that.
Madam Chair, I don't know that there would be any specific certification, but it would be under the direction of the physicians with... I mean, nurse practitioners are allowed independent practice in this state, mm-hmm. and they are not required to get any specific certification for any specific procedures they do,
there we go.
I think. But I believe Ms. Baker can help me out here.
I believe that was what was said during testimony.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Byer, there's a credentialing process that employers and insurance companies would require a nurse practitioner to go through to demonstrate competency in the procedure.
So to be real clear, so they would have to be properly credentialed before they could do the procedure?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Byer, absolutely. And, of course, no nurse practitioner would even think of performing a procedure he or she was not qualified to perform.
They might think about it. They just won't do it.
And I would say, having been through a bunch of credentialing for procedures, it means you have to provide documentation that you've done a certain number of them, depending on what the facility or insurance company requires. You may need a letter of support from whoever trained you. I went through this when I got C-section privileges, which is a little unusual for my position.
Okay. Any other discussion? Clerk will call. Oh, did you?
It's already
been. Yeah.
On
the clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Senator
Knope? Aye.
Senator
Steiner-Hanner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman
Sanders? Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill?
I'll take it.
Senator Steiner.
I think one of the men should take it for sure.
You're getting too personal now.
Senator Hayward will carry the bill. And colleagues, we cannot discuss 2838. It has an amendment until 142. And so what I'd like to do is go into our informational hearing, which should be about a half hour or so, and then we will address the last bill. Okay? So with that, I will open an informational hearing on the chiropractic treatment of concussions.
No, we did it while we were here.
Glenn Zielinski, Terry Porter, and Amelia Smythe.
CBS's bills.
Oh.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Glenn Zielinski. I'm a chiropractic physician. I practice in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm also board certified in chiropractic neurology. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Functional Neurology, a certified brain injury specialist, and I've been treating functional neurology cases internationally and teaching internationally since 2003. I trained everyone from chiropractors to head of neurosurgery wards in functional neurology treatment. And our protocols are largely about restoring function in traumatic brain injuries. And I'm essentially here to help dispel some of the myths that chiropractors don't know anything about how to treat concussions. Now, I'm massively overprepared on this. I just cut together a bunch of lectures that I generally give as the keynote speaker at the Oregon Brain Injury Alliance Conference. So I'm going to skip over a whole ton of slides and just cut to the chase. The essence of a traumatic brain injury, when somebody has a significant concussion and they're dealing with persistent post-concussion syndrome, when they have symptoms that have been lingering for any extended period of time, the majority of those symptoms are largely based on the fact that the brain is struggling to make sense out of where it is in the environment. Now, that's a function of a number of different pathways in the system. There's visual pathways that your brain uses to make sense out of where the environment is in relation to your body. There's vestibular or inner ear pathways that your brain uses to make sense out of where your head is in relation to gravity and in relation to movement. And then there's proprioceptive feedback, which is basically stretch receptors from muscles and joints. And the brain uses all of these different types of inputs to try to localize in space. And one of the main things that happens when somebody suffers a significant concussion is that they shear the integration of those pathways because they all come together right in the middle of the brainstem in the area that suffers the most torque when somebody has a multivectorial impact, right in the middle of an area called the pons. And the pons is where your inner ear fires initially, where the feedback from your vestibular sense that lets you know where your head is, that's where it goes first. That's where a lot of the pathways that fire down to drive muscles and joints start. And that's also where a lot of visual pathways that are functioning in things like gaze stabilization. So the ability to park your eyes on targets and keep them there, that's where those pathways live. And the essence of most symptoms when somebody has a significant brain injury comes down to the fact that those pathways are saying different things at different times in different circumstances. And as a consequence, patients become overwhelmed by sensory input. They become fatigued. They develop brain fog. They develop headaches as the brain tries to fire reflex neck stabilizing muscles to try to make sense out of the fact that the eyes don't match the inner ear and so on and so forth. Now, I'm going to just very rapidly skip through a whole pile of slides that say essentially everything I just said and cut ahead to the literature that ends saying that being able to map out all of these different pathways utilizing electrodiagnostic testing, utilizing things called video nystagmography and posturography and some other stuff that we're going to get into, the literature is now emerging saying that these are the gold standard technologies for not only being able to evaluate a traumatic brain injury, but also being able to understand what it is to do to treat them. So in my office, I essentially have several hundred thousand dollars worth of equipment that allows me to do all of this stuff. So we start by evaluating things called video nystagmography, which are essentially infrared recordings of eye movements. And the reason that's important is that if you take a look at like a brain image, if you look at an MRI, you're essentially looking at a snapshot of tissue, but you're not really doing much to evaluate function. These specific eye movement pathways, different types of eye movements localize to different parts of the brain, and you can not only evaluate function in different aspects of the brain, but you can also evaluate fatigability, which is critical when somebody has a traumatic brain injury, because frequently it's not so much that pathways don't work as that pathways lose endurance and fatigue under particular types of stimulus. So in these situations, you can look at a host of different types of eye movements. This is a pursuit movement where somebody's following a target, moving back and forth. Infrared cameras are tracking all of this and graphing it so that we can quantify the function of these different types of movements. And there's a host of different types of eye movements that we assess in that process. We also look at dynamic posturography. Well over 50% of traumatic brain injury patients have got some kind of a balance impairment or some level of dizziness or vertigo. And the literature demonstrates that posturography is the appropriate way to evaluate that. We can not only see what normal looks like, but we can tease out different combinations of sensory inputs with eyes open, eyes closed, different head positions, and so on and so forth to be able to bring out occult disorders dysfunction in those pathways, to be able to assess and demonstrate things that appear to be working under a normal examination but fail when placed under stress, which is the essence of a brain injury, because people fail when placed under different types of sensory stress. We look at other types of eye movement, saccadometry. This is another infrared recording that allows you to very precisely evaluate frontal lobe eye movements, and the literature demonstrates that this is very, very precisely correlating with cognitive deficits in traumatic brain injury, and can even elicit this more effectively than neurocognitive testing can, and more importantly, can demonstrate impairments in brain function that are beyond the level of conscious control, which is kind of critical when you're looking at trying to evaluate, say, for example, a sports concussion, because the traditional gold standards are basically things like impact tests and SCAT tests, which are essentially questionnaires that players fill out in advance of going on at the beginning of their season. And it's also pretty well represented in the literature that a lot of players that expect they're going to have some opportunity to wind up in college on scholarships, they lie with their initial assessments to create symptoms that look much worse than they actually are, so that if they actually do get concussed and they can go and test, then their scores match and somebody still puts them back out on the field. Whereas this sort of objective testing can demonstrate very, very precisely whether a pathway works or whether it does not work. We also look at head impulse testing, vestibular head impulse testing, which is a way of assessing how well inner ear function works. And once again, that gives you an opportunity to quantify all of the different pathways that are associated with something that happens in a traumatic brain injury. Now, I've been asked to present a few cases. This case, Perry, this is actually, I was initially presenting this without HIPAA coverage a long time ago. I forgot to change his name back. This is actually Terry. Terry is the patient that was going to be testifying today. Unfortunately, we found out yesterday that his sister suffered a stroke, so he's in California in the hospital with her right now. But nevertheless, this is his case. So he's a veteran. He fought in Grenada. He was 64 years old. He had several concussions while he was in service, and he had severe vertigo and severe PTSD. His injury was essentially he was hit in the back of the head with an M16 by another American service member. All right. And he suffered from severe agoraphobia and severe acrophobia. So he's terrified of going outside. Large open spaces are a disaster for him, and he has horrible fear of heights. He has anxiety and panic that develops in social situations involving multiple people or multiple conversations. He's easily overstimulated by complicated visual and auditory environments. These are classic findings of people that have had significant traumatic brain injuries. He's got a constant sensation of motion and vertigo and very poor balance, and his vertigo and instability are debilitating. He's reached to the point where he's got constant pain in his upper back and neck. He's got constant headaches. He's been receiving regular physical therapy. It's only palliative. It's not helping him on any level other than just ameliorating the symptoms temporarily. His pain ranges from 3 to 7 out of 10. It's constant. He's got cognitive processing difficulties, impaired processing speed, his working memory shot. He can't find words. He can't express himself. And he's reached the point where he's got severe social withdrawal. He's unable to leave the house for months at a time because his vertigo triggers severe panic attacks. And his life is essentially broken down to the point where the only contact he has with any other humans are with his spouse and with all of his medical providers. Now, So basically, he was a veteran. He was being treated at the VA. The VA gave him 100% disability for his post-concussion and his PTSD. This was a very, very severe case. Now, he received every therapy that was indicated by extremely qualified practitioners. He'd been receiving care since the Grenada invasion, so whenever that was, 1983 or whatever, right? So he came to see us. We mapped out all of these different findings. And the relevant things for him were largely that his gaze stability when he was trying to follow moving targets had utterly failed. And if you look at this graph, this is basically a target that's moving to the right and then moving to the left. And the other line on top of it, that's his eye movements. And he's got no gaze stability. Now, again, he'd already been treated for and received gaze stabilization exercises for several years with traditional vestibular therapists and hadn't accomplished anything that was able to stabilize him, because his issue wasn't just about eyes. His issue was also about inner ear function and the way that those pathways integrated. And the reason that this is relevant is that every time his eyes would jerk like that, there's a reflex contraction of his upper cervical spine that would create not only neck pain but referred pain headaches. And more importantly for him, if you can't figure out where you are in the world visually, the world becomes a very scary place. And as a consequence, there's good literature that's demonstrated that these sorts of eye movement pathways are directly linked with PTSD, and ameliorating these issues can function more effectively than a lot of the gold standard treatments for PTSD, such as medication and talk therapy. So we walked him through all these different processes, And over the space of, so we gave them all these different types of therapies that essentially came down to like particular types of electrical stimulus and some specific eye and inner ear exercises that were very specific for exactly what he had going on so that we could stabilize these pathways. And I'll skip over all that stuff. It's pretty technical. But anyway, after 16 treatments over 8 weeks, so I'm twice a week for 8 weeks, this is what his eye movement starts to look like. So now they've essentially returned back to normal. Things are functioning the way that they should. And more importantly, he takes his son to a Portland Trail Blazers game. And for somebody who has severe fear of heights and fear of open spaces, going to a Trail Blazers game and sitting in the cheap seats is like the worst of all possible things, right? Not to mention all the sensory overstimulus that comes from that. He goes there. He has a great time. He has no problem. He comes back, tells me it was like the best day of his of the last 10 years. Fast forward from that. 6 weeks into care, and again, understand, like, severe fear of heights, severe fear of open spaces. He texts me a picture of himself after just hiking Angel's Rest, and he's 5 feet away from a 1,000-foot cliff, right? So he's back in the game. This was all about rehabbing the pathways. But more importantly, this the point I'm trying to raise is that our treatment is not about being able to do things that nobody else does. Our treatment is about being able to utilize the literature, the medical literature, and having a unique status within our scope of practice that allows us to be able to not only understand and diagnose these conditions, but actually have the freedom to be able to intervene without the traditional standards of care that exist within in medicine, where you would try to treat something like this with the headaches with migraine medication or refer to somebody who quite literally doesn't have the training to be able to map these sorts of pathways out and rehab them appropriately. And we can say this was the case in his case because that had already happened several times. All right, so that's one case. Let me show you another one. This is a woman named Rosie. Now, Rosie's a 27-year-old female. July 2015, she has a trampoline accident. She does a backflip. She hits her head on the way down, stubs her head, develops some headaches. She's got constant headaches. She has dizziness. She's got photophobia. She has brain fog, poor working memory, poor spatial awareness, standard post-concussion syndrome symptoms. She is not without resources. She's got a number of people that are trying to help her out. So she's seen by an extremely comprehensive team of professionals. She's seen by a medical neurologist. She's seen by a PMR, a physical medicine and rehabilitation, board-certified sports medicine doctor in a hospital concussion clinic. She's seen, they refer her to a physical therapist that specializes in vestibular therapy. She's seen by an osteopathic physician to help work with her neck pain. She's seen by a massage therapist. She sees a naturopathic physician to try to deal with some other metabolic issues that may be provoking some of this. She sees a registered dietitian, and she works with a personal trainer. So this is about as comprehensive as you ever see for anybody receiving concussion care. And they begin doing treatment like gaze stabilization and vestibular habituation therapy, which is standard protocol stuff within those sorts of treatment parameters. And she gradually improves. 3 weeks in, she has another evaluation. She still has some light sensitivity, sound sensitivity. She's still got impaired spatial awareness, and she still has mild headaches. Now, from there, we fast forward a few more weeks. She hits her head getting into a car door. And the worst thing that happens when somebody has a concussion is that they have a second concussion before the first one is healed, because brain immune cells are still active for about 3 months after an injury, and they have a tendency to become primed, and they can create a ton of collateral damage when they're reactivated, which is what happens for her. So as a consequence, all of her symptoms dramatically increase, and now she's forced to take 2 weeks off from all activity, and she spends 2 weeks at the behest of her medical neurologist, basically hiding in a dark room with the lights off and avoiding all sensory stimulus. She emerges from that and starts to receive care from the rest of her team of professionals. However, despite all of their best efforts to intervene, she's getting progressively worse. At this point, she can engage in very, very simple physical activity, but anything complex, anything involving any kind of physical exertion, anything involving balance, anything even involving like turning her head rapidly, causes her to get disoriented and foggy. Any activity provokes her light sensitivity and her sound sensitivity. She now has severe headaches that are provoked by exertion. They persist all through the day. She only feels comfortable when she's turning to her left side. She can't fall asleep. She can't stay asleep. And now she's becoming very anxious and labile. And so her emotional stability is starting to fail. The medical lead on that case called me up, asked me to attend to her. When I met her, I asked her what her goals were, and she basically told me that she'd been planning this trip to South America for about 4 years, and she wasn't able to travel in this condition. So I went to work with her, and I was able to map out a few things, such as her ability to visually map the environment with fast eye movements was compromised. That what this graph demonstrates is that whenever she would try to look to the right, her eyes would jump past the target. which is very inappropriate because now she can't localize herself visually in the world. And not only that, this is a latency distribution, which basically demonstrates how fast your eye should be able to react to visual stimuli. That should be well below 200 milliseconds. She's pushing 240. That's a circumstance where she's not reacting to the world fast enough. And then more significantly, we look at the rest of her eye movements. They all look pretty much okay. But then you get down to this. This is a vestibular head impulse test. And this maps out something called a vestibulo-ocular reflex, a VOR. And the idea of a VOR is that when you turn your head rapidly, your eyes get propelled in the opposite direction. And that allows you to not only figure out where your head is in relation to space and how it's moving, but allow you to maintain gaze stability on the world. And that's critically important. That's how you figure out where you are in space. VORs are probably the most important thing that needs to be rehabilitated in the presence of a traumatic brain injury. And in her case, one of her VOR mechanisms was toast. Whenever she would move her head forward and to the right, she wouldn't get appropriate feedback from that system. And if you look at this graph, if you think this is her, that little dot is her, and we're staring down on top of her, whenever she would move forward, the green line over here demonstrates the input that she's getting from her left anterior canal in her vestibular system, and the red line is what she's getting from the right side, and they're obviously very asymmetric. So as a consequence, whenever she would move her head forward, her brain would think she's moving forward and left. Whenever she would move her head back, her brain would think she'd be moving forward and right. And as a consequence, she would fire the wrong muscle at the wrong time to try to stabilize, and that would provoke her headaches and her dizziness and everything else. So I worked with her, and you know, we gave her a series of exercises that, again, were about attempts to try to stabilize her gaze in particular types of head movement planes and getting her neck working again and reestablishing her perception of where she is in the environment. And I worked with her for a solid one-hour session, then I gave her a bunch of exercises, and then I did a follow-up with her in 2 weeks. And all of her symptoms resolved, and she was able to go on her trip. And so she shows up in Rio, grabs the Canadian flag, walks the Canadian Olympic team in, decides she's going to try a trampoline again. Whoops. This was actually worth seeing. Decides that she's going to try a trampoline again, and I can't make this fly. That's too bad, because this is... Oh, maybe I can.
15 up her sleeve from qualification.
This is her second Olympic gold medal.
That's the hardest routine right? we've seen from anybody.
So she was the defending Olympic perfectly champion this time. In trampoline. She was the only Canadian
gold medalist. A long time to prepare her jumps. Earlier,
it's pretty clear that she knows where she is in space.
Not so this time. This is looking strong.
Right. And again, this was somebody who every time she would turn her head to the left, she'd get headaches.
She's holding their breath. Vertigo, she's got to keep the height going now.
So that's
strong.
A sign that's actually functioning pretty well, right?
Can she finish it off?
And
it's good.
That's much better from McLennan.
Like
a couple of jumps.
Is at the end, when you see her on the podium, you can see that left eye starting to drift back out. That's a sign of some significant fatigue as a result of what she just did, right? That was one of the neurologic deficits we were working on the whole time.
Wow.
Anyway, so there's my point, right? The difference between what I was able to do with her and what everyone else was able to do with her was just entirely based on having the skills and the tools to be able to quantify exactly what her deficits were and not follow protocols, but create something that was unique to her brain. Here's another one. This is a patient with a severe TBI and a locked-in syndrome. Now, what's locked-in syndrome? Locked-in syndrome is a savage brain injury. Locked-in syndrome is a situation where there's a lower brainstem injury that basically destroys all the pathways that go between the descending parts of the brain and everything that you use to express yourself in your environment. So locked-in syndrome patients, they're generally paralyzed. They can't communicate. They're the horrible patient. They're the horrible nightmare that we all have about being stuck in our own body and not being able to express ourselves. A lot of locked-in patients are in a circumstance where the best that they can ever hope is to be able to communicate by blinking or sniffing or, in some cases, moving their eyes back and forth. Total locked-in syndrome is a situation where the eyes are paralyzed as well. All right.
That's not the same as I'm thinking of. My mother had a stroke that was totally paralyzed. That's different.
Well, this is different because, I mean, generally, when somebody gets totally paralyzed after a stroke, you're talking about destroying the motor cortex.
Okay.
And there's a lot of other frontal lobe function that goes down with that. Okay. These are patients that are generally entirely cognitively intact, all right? But they can't express anything because they're literally trapped inside their brains based on damage to the lower brainstem pathways that prevent any opportunity to express anything, any motor function, any vocalization. Like I said, usually at best they have eye movements. All right, they can sometimes communicate with coded messages. The problem with these people is that they retain sensation, so their lives are hell because they're essentially treated largely as pieces of meat by all their caregivers, and they're subjected to all kinds of horrible procedures and so on and so forth. People are continually testing, can they still feel pain, you know, and stuff like that. That's not exactly the most most therapeutic for the patient, right? So there's no standard cure. The level of independence is directly related to motor recovery. Very few people reach a level of motor recovery that allows them to be able to stand or ambulate or in any way, shape, or form take care of themselves. And the prognosis for patients that suffer both brainstem injuries, which are the standard locked-in syndromes, and upper brain injuries is extremely poor. All right, so this is my patient, Stephanie. So she's 21 years old. She's a pre-med student. She's on her way to class at Boston University. She's involved in an MBA. Her car is literally crushed by a semi. It takes like 2 hours for her to be extracted. She's airlifted to the hospital. She shows up with broken ribs, a collapsed lung, a lacerated liver, internal bleeding, a fractured pelvis, multiple right arm fractures, multiple left arm fractures, a fractured jaw, multiple skull fractures, severe multi-site intracranial hemorrhage, massive multi-site internal bleeding. She's put in a coma for 2 weeks. She has multiple reconstructive surgeries. She's in ICU for 2 months. They place a shunt to try to drain the pressure that's building up inside her brain. And on her initial examination, she's completely locked in. She's fully locked in. She's non-ambulatory. She's got all this different type of posturing that demonstrates this. She's had a severe upper as well as brainstem injury. And all these other findings. She can't generate any volitional eye movements. She's unresponsive to any commands. The only motion that she's developing is what appears to be just sort of like a random truncal twitch every once in a while. So she's got a multi-site brain lesion. And this is the worst prognosis possible, right? So I'm talking with the parents, and I'm asking them what it is that they're hoping that I can generate for them, and they just say, we'll take anything that we can. And in the middle of this, Stephanie sort of gently leans forward and very, very slowly appears to kind of lock eyes with me. So I start to get the impression that she might actually still be functional and not just like a persistent vegetative state case. And I have this thing where I traditionally tell these patients, just in the interest of seeing if I'm going to be able to generate any kind of a response, that I'm going to do horrible things to them in the process of getting them better, and that my goal is to get them to the point where they can beat me up for it. And I said that, and I could see this slow pupil dilation that indicated just enough of a response for me to think that there might be something that we can work with. So we brought her into my office, and we did 2 weeks of inpatient therapy where we worked on her hourly, you know, 5 or 6 times a day, and did all this different stuff that was essentially utilizing inner ear exercises and electrical stimulus and all these different things to try to build up different aspects of her brain function. And she started to respond to commands, and she started giving us some capacity to look back and forth. And after a while, it became pretty clear that those were actually voluntary. And then after 2 weeks, this is...
Get him. Okay.
Oh, that's nice.
Let's try to get to Dr. Z.
I don't know how that video got sideways.
Let's go get Dr. Z. Yeah.
But the point is that that's Stephanie walking by with assistance, right? And kind of mugging for the camera.
You're running me down, man.
Everybody.
After a month, here she is. Once again, sideways video. Don't know why that is. But now she's walking by herself, and she's got some reasonable motor control, and she's engaging on an emotional level. And I had another video that I wanted to stick in on this, but I discovered that it's on another presentation, and it's of her actually coming over and punching me in the face, which was, I thought, wonderful payback.
That's pretty good. Okay.
So there it is. So essentially, I hope I'm making the case that chiropractors can treat brain injuries. All right, we treat brain injuries in conjunction with all sorts of other practitioners. I have somewhere, I was putting a Christmas card list together for all my referral providers a little while ago, and I stopped counting at 700, right? I've got medical physicians that send me patients. I've got chiropractors that send me patients. I've got people from like Rebound Orthopedics and Sports Medicine of Oregon that send me their patients to try to figure out what still needs to be done in order to fix them, and so on and so forth. I refer to medical physicians all the time when there's things that are outside of my scope to be able to treat, or things that I just feel that they could treat more effectively than I could. I've got a very solid referral pipeline within my profession, where most chiropractic physicians that I know that send me patients, they send me the things that they don't know how to treat, or more importantly, they don't see responding the way that they think that they should. So they refer patients into me usually after a few weeks of care, sometimes after a few months. If patients aren't responding the way that they want, frequently I'm the next step. And I hope that makes enough of a case.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Zielinski, thank you. This was informative and interesting. I have never doubted the chiropractors can treat concussions. That has never been my concern. My concern, frankly, as a family physician who diagnoses a lot of them but chooses not to treat them because I don't have enough, I'm spending a lot of time here, in practice, is the same concern I have with almost anything else, that people overestimate that providers, whether they're MDs or DOs or DCs or NDs or pretty much anybody else, don't know enough to know their own limits. And one of the questions I have for you, I have two questions. The first is, one is, how do we help educate all providers who see people with concussions about the available? I learned a lot from your presentation, and it's one of the many reasons I don't treat these folks, because I don't have time to stay up to date, right?
Yeah, fair enough.
But I think that a lot of people aren't staying up to date. And one of my questions for you is, given that we're paying so much more attention to concussions, as we should, in both young people and older people, how do we really get the information out there about the availability and the necessity for some of this training to providers and some of these treatments that people might need to be referred for?
Well, I don't know that I can speak for anyone outside of my own profession on that, although I know that within my profession there's a very large push to educate our population, right? So, for example, on next Saturday, not this Saturday, but the coming Saturday, I'm teaching an 8-hour class for the Oregon Chiropractic Association on evaluation and treatment of traumatic brain injuries. And the focus of this class is not to bring people up to speed where they're going to be capable of doing anything like that, but rather it's to show them exactly what all the signposts are, where it's time to stop following their traditional musculoskeletal protocols and actually take the neurologic findings as a sign that it's time to refer on to somebody else, be it me or be it up to OHSU or wherever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where this stuff becomes dicey is that a lot of times what winds up happening with a brain injury looks like a musculoskeletal injury, especially if there's a superimposed musculoskeletal injury. So classic chiropractic brain injury case, for example, will be something like somebody has a vestibular injury that they develop in a car accident, right? And in that process, somebody's got their head turned to the side and their head gets slammed forward to the left and back to the right. And in the process, they stun two canals in their vestibular system and other inner ear doesn't work properly.
Right.
And in the process, they develop an upper cervical injury. They have a whiplash. And now they've got all this musculoskeletal damage. And at the same time, the eyes no longer match the inner ear. And how does the brain try to stabilize against that by creating a head tilt that fires these muscles, right? And if this massive muscle spasm creates dizziness, headaches, or balance problems, things like that, the brain doesn't really care. It's just trying to make sure it doesn't fall. And to most practitioners, at least for the initial course of treatment, that's going to look just like a whiplash injury. You know what I'm saying?
I totally understand what you're saying.
So as a consequence, we're establishing protocols that allow people to be able to assess the difference. So one of the ways to test that, to make sense out of that, is actually by looking at bedside evaluation of vestibulo-ocular reflexes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very simple tests to do that. And people are trained to do that, and they don't always know when it's appropriate to engage in those things. And the signposts are generally, if people aren't responding after 2 weeks, it's time to move on, right? But at the same time, testing things like that at the beginning, there's some very simple bedside tests that people can engage in that can at least give them the insight that now they need to treat this as a neurologic case. And if they don't respond just to pure musculoskeletal treatment, then it's time to level up and refer. So that's the essence of 8 hours of education that I'm going to be giving these people in 2 weeks.
And my second question, if I may, Madam Chair, is this. One of the challenges that I think all of us face when we refer people, whether it's to a cardiothoracic surgeon or someone who has expertise in rehabilitation after concussion, is identifying who has these specialized kinds of equipment and skills and stuff. Do you have any sense about how those of us in Oregon, what kinds of resources are available where it's really clear? Because people can say they specialize in all sorts of stuff, and one has to evaluate those claims, regardless of professional credential, carefully. So do you have a sense of whether there's some kind of a centralized resource or there should be some kind of a centralized resource?
Well, I would like to think that there should be a centralized resource, absolutely. But beyond that, I can also point out that Chiropractic neurology, functional neurology, I was instrumental in getting that built into the scope of practice in Oregon, and because I had to go in front of the Oregon board and argue the case and all this sort of stuff. There's this whole procedure, the ETDSP process. I wish I could remember what that acronym stands for. But we had to build a big petition and so on and so forth and ultimately argue it in front of our state board. And in the process of doing that, they amended our legislation such that in order for anyone to be able to advertise treating neurologic cases, they had to be at least board certified or board eligible. So based on that, anybody that is saying in Oregon that they are treating concussions needs to have at least some level of neurologic training. All right. Now, that's to treat significant concussions. All right. That's to be able to advertise yourself as being a neurologist. That's significantly different than just being able to go off and treat a concussion, because the sort of garden variety concussions, the things that get better, that are self-limiting and so on and so forth, that stuff's already been well established within just the scope of practice of everyone in our profession. That's our basic training. Everyone has that basic training. But in terms of like being able to provide specialty care, there are a number of different functional neurology boards, and the functional neurology boards are in many cases chiropractors, but also medical physicians and osteopathic physicians and so on and so forth. There's three of them that are operating, or four of them actually, that are operating in the United States. They all have some sort of like provider referral matrix. There's opportunities for people to be able to find local providers that are skilled in these sorts of things. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of us to have that level of organization that we can be broadcasting this sort of stuff to the public very well. That's why I'm very tightly tied in with the Brain Injury Alliance of Oregon and so on and so forth, because they function as a pretty solid central repository for this kind of information.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for him?
That's fascinating.
All right, thank you. Appreciate the time.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, no one's going to be handing me an Olympic flag to carry in, but I'm Amelia Pismyth. I live in Southwest Portland. I'm a full-time single parent of two teenage boys, and I work as a nonprofit executive from a virtual home office. And I'm here today as a former patient of Dr. Glenn Zielinski to share my story of brain rehabilitation at Northwest Functional Neurology and to testify in support of the addition of chiropractors to the list of healthcare providers approved to authorize return to play after concussion. So in my introduction, I mentioned my work environment in order to underscore the complete reliance I have on a high-functioning brain in order to sustain my occupation. I need to be capable of analysis, conceptualization, abstract reasoning, and prioritization, all while multitasking across several computer programs and speaking or presenting on a telephone or video conference. It's intense, but my situation is far from unique. The same demands are at play for most workers today, as well as most students. From our performance to our personality and functional terms, we are, in many ways, our brains. And so we're very fortunate that awareness of the frequency and impact of concussions is becoming better known. Despite being generally aware of concussions, particularly from caring for my two boys following mild sports concussions, when I was badly concussed, I didn't realize right away how hurt I was. And I now understand that this phenomenon is common. And in my situation, without another adult in my home or an in-person office where someone would have experienced me across many hours, across many days, and surely noticed my struggle, there was a gap of time where I was simply following the patterns of my daily life with less and less success. I started seeing an occupational therapist and a chiropractor for my whiplash injuries to my shoulder, neck, and jaw, and both of them quickly recognized that I had a concussion. A couple of weeks further into their care, they both responded with increasing alarm as I reported my daily headaches, extreme fatigue, light sensitivity, confusion, disorientation, particularly when I was trying to sleep, emotional dysregulation, and inability to follow all of the way through on tasks. At work, I was struggling to process information efficiently, type accurately, or speak with fluency. I did not feel safe to travel cross-country on my own, and certainly could not perform my usual functions that involve quite a bit of public speaking.
So my chiropractor, Dr. Todd Turnbull, referred me to Dr. Glenn Zielinski. And Dr. Z's team did a thorough intake evaluation. Many of the tests and graphs that he showed in his presentation are familiar to me. And from those charts and graphs, was able to craft a specific care path that would guide my rehabilitation. Each time I came into the office, the treatment was highly individualized, where the therapist would test and regulate the prescribed exercises based on how I showed up that given day. And Dr. Z would check in and monitor my progress with each appointment. So I didn't include it in my written testimony, but a complicating factor for my head injury recovery was that I had a history of left eye blindness. And so I was very fortunate to be in Dr. Zielinski's care because my brain rehabilitation provided an opportunity to also, I believe, provide some support for the impacts of having been blind prior to a cornea transplant in 2010. Under his care, within 1 month of treatment, my headaches began to dissipate. Within 2 months, I began to multitask at work, though I still needed to take frequent breaks, and it was very fortunate that I worked at home. Within 4 months, I had increased energy and could travel for work again. And within 6 months, I resumed public speaking and experienced improved functionality at home and also a steadying of my emotional temperament. Within 10 months, I was processing at a meta level again. I was aware of myself. I was synthesizing inputs from many sources at one time, at the same time, and at rapid speed and in public forums. So, as you can imagine, I'm very grateful for the chiropractors that have diagnosed and treated mild concussions throughout my 20 years' experience of raising active boys, and for my chiropractor's choice to refer me on to rehabilitation with Dr. Zielinski, a chiropractor who, as we've seen, has specialized care in functional neurology. Professionally, I work in maternal child health, and breastfeeding look a lot at scope of practice and licensure issues for an entirely different field. And I bring that lens when I look at what's before you today. The matter certainly reads as more of an administrative fix to me, consistent with the purview of chiropractor scope of practice and the license in Oregon. So it seems that adding them to the return to playlist is sensible and corrects perhaps what appears to be an earlier oversight. Although, again, I'm speaking as a layperson, citizen, and someone who's benefited from this care. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Question. All right, and the reason I wanted to have this informational is because we're going to have a work group to deal with concussions, allowing chiropractors to be on the sports field to help with this endeavor. So that's why we have it, and I just wanted to make sure the committee members were aware of what was happening. And Terry Porter's not. All right. With that, I'll close the informational, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2838. And I apologize for not having the amendment, the dash A6s, and so they were posted at 1242. And I'd like you to... Yeah, summarize, and then we'll have Art come up and explain the A6s.
Do you want Mark as well, maybe, for
that? Yeah, so we have the A5s, which I think were put into the A6s. But go ahead and...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2838. The bill received a public hearing on May 11th. The bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to provide grants to organizations to give application assistance to individuals eligible for Medicaid. It specifies that at least one representative be available for every 1,000 Medicaid recipients in Oregon. And the bill establishes OHA's a sister fund, and the state treasury specifies that CCOs may voluntarily contribute to the fund and requires OHA to update and provide OHB member enrollment data to CCOs. There's a dash A5, which expands the types of organizations that would be eligible for the grants. There's also the dash A6, which, as the chair indicated, was released about 20 minutes before committee. So the analyst has not had time to digest the A6, but I think we have the requester in front of us.
Okay, so Martin, let's have you talk about the A5s, and then we're going to have Art talk about the A6s.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing Care Oregon and its affiliated CCOs, Jackson Care Connect and Columbia Pacific CCO. The AFIs are very easy. They expand the folks that are eligible to be in the assister program from not-for-profits to any organization. And there are actually more CLO amendments that we've accepted in, so if you had any more specific questions, you could bring them to us. But we recommend that you bring the A5s into the bill.
Okay. Thank you. All right. The A6s.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Art Suhorzewski, family represent Family Care Health, Portland area CCO. So the dash A6 amendments, which we've just seen in the last hour, do a number of things. Namely, some of the most important pieces are allowing all CCOs to help re-enroll their members. The underlying bill does not include that permission for all CCOs. That's restricted to only CCOs that don't have that serve areas where there's only one coordinated care organization. It also would prohibit any marketing of CCOs at enrollment areas. We believe that that preserves the independence of the application assistance program. It also has some teeth in terms of OHA's oversight of what the application assisters are responsible for. And there's also a provision in here that allows CCOs to see inside the OHA's database. They don't presently allow us to do that, and if they're going to have if they're going to provide training for CCOs to fix errors, then we should be able to see inside that system. And then it also allows counties and cities and other nonprofit organizations to contribute to the fund. We believe that is reasonable, and contributing more resources would help ensure that there's one for every 1,000 application assisters.
Great.
Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, do you view the A5s and A6s as compatible?
Senator Beyer, I believe they are. I just have been looking at them in the last hour. I believe some of those changes were incorporated into A6, but I believe they are, yes.
And that's why we
won't. Same question, Martin.
Yeah.
You know, again, looked online. I actually think in terms of making sure the A5s are covered by the A6s, maybe Morgan Cowing would be the best person, just since they're her amendments, to let you know.
Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to we'll have to carry the bill over to give time for everybody to look. And you need to get back to me very quickly on the A6s. I think there are no problems with the A5s, but I really liked a lot of what the A6s said. So OHA and needs to give us input as well as everybody else. Okay? All right.
We have someone else wants to talk, Madam Chair.
Do you want Morgan?
No. I think we're fine with what you want. And then we'll discuss more of the A6s. Because we just got them. We just got the A6s. Yeah.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, just for the record, this is my second to last day at Care Oregon. So to the extent that I'm prepared to talk about the A6s today, I could do that. Or and a future date, you could have someone less experienced with the bill walk you through it. It's your preference, but
well,
I do want to let you know.
I mean, I would just as soon get your input today. We're still, it'll be, the
31st.
It'll be the 1st, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll officially have turned into ONA by the 1st. So.
Yes, okay.
So just a couple comments. First, there are four things that the Family Care Amendments do. The first of those four things is allows a greater number of folks to contribute to the fund, and we think that's a good change. The second thing it does is it changes the part of the statute, the part of the bill that says that only in non-competitive areas can CCOs provide enrollment assistance. So let's first recognize that in current law, no CCO, regardless of where it is, can provide enrollment assistance. And that's been the state taking a conservative approach to federal laws that prohibit choice counseling. The language as it's in the bill was deliberately written to address this concern of OHA. If you don't have competing CCOs, then federal law's prohibition on choice counseling shouldn't affect you. So if you take the Family Care Amendment and you allow CCOs in areas where there are competitive CCOs, it's very likely that you'll trigger the federal government to say, oh, now we have a choice counseling problem. So I would not take that part of these amendments until you get some clarity from OHA and possibly from the feds that you aren't severely restricting what CCOs in non-competitive areas can do as a result of the federal government trying to prevent choice counseling in competitive areas.
On the whole, do you think that's a good idea?
Obviously, aside from
what the feds are telling.
Right, an overwhelming percentage of Care Oregon members are in competitive areas, and it would certainly be something that Care Oregon would feel good about if the federal government would allow it. So really, this is us being responsive to OHA's caution. But if it was something that OHA came back and said, yeah, doing it in competitive areas isn't going to make a difference, we're going to get the same allowance from the federal government either way, then, yeah, we'd support that. Third thing is...
Just a minute.
Let me just speak to what Martin just said, because family... thank you, Madam Chair. Family Care's experience is that we never have any clarity from the OHA as to what the policy actually is. So that we don't actually think there is a conflict with federal regulations as it pertains to helping re-enroll our members. Right now, Family Care's members only remain in our membership 38% of the time during the year. We want to increase that number to 100% if possible. And so the language that we submitted to LC actually says that OHA shall seek the federal approval necessary to do what we want them to do. And so we don't think that's a conflict with federal law or regulation.
It's the conservative approach of OHA.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say that's we have conflicting opinions about what federal law requires and what OHA is interpreting, and I think it is a conservative interpretation. We should just not rest on Art's opinion or my opinion. We really should. That's one of those things that before you make the change, we should get some clarity if you want to go that direction so we don't inadvertently continue to constrict CCOs in non-competitive areas. But again, most of Care Oregon's members are in competitive areas, and if we can do it, that would be great.
I do think, though, that could legislative council give us that direction? I know what OHA would say, since they like taking a conservative approach, but if we would ask legislative council if they feel this is in violation of federal law, if we could get that turned around quickly, it would be nice to know. Okay.
The third thing that there's four things that it does. The third thing is it affects the application assister process. Now, this is an area where I think we've just had a lot more time working with OHA and with this part of policy than the folks proposing the amendment. I think there is a lot of value to having a conversation around how our application assister program is run, and there are ways it could run better, and some of the provisions that they're introducing aren't bad. But some of them are costly. So we managed to navigate this bill through the House without having to go through Ways and Means, in part by reducing the amount of additional cost on OHA. My fear is that in order to try to address a question of how to improve the existing assister program, you're going to end up putting a fiscal on the bill and forcing it to go to Ways and Means. The one other thing I would say is one of the additions is something that says that from a promoting standpoint, you have to have CCOs have their signage 1,000 feet away from assister programs. That makes a lot more sense in competitive areas than non-competitive areas. So if a majority of the CCOs are in non-competitive areas, a majority of the geography of the state is in non-competitive areas, in those areas it actually makes a lot of sense to co-locate an assister and a plan. So when someone's getting assistance on how to get into the plan, they're also learning about the plan and the network at the same time. They're understanding their benefits at the same time. So I would want to know what the fiscal is, and I'd also have a lot of caution about not essentially tilting the assister rules in favor for regulations that make sense in competitive areas but don't make sense in non-competitive areas.
Well, and to me, it just, mm-hmm. It is very frustrating to me that every CCO can't can't just go ahead and re-enroll themselves, re-enroll their clients by themselves without then having OHA intervene to make sure you did it right. I mean, it's a very cumbersome bureaucratic mess.
And so let's recognize that there are three current protections against a sister showing bias. The first protection is all sisters are trained, and part of their training is how to do unbiased choice counseling. The second is that anybody applying for a grant to get an assister has to demonstrate to OHA that they're going to be unbiased in how they oversee and manage that assister. And then the third is every assister has an individualized code that shows which folks they assisted and which ones they don't, and OHA can look and say, well, you know, assister number 4361, 60% of your referrals are to family care and only 40% are to health share, so what's with that? So there are three existing checks. I'm not saying this isn't an area where improvement can be made. I don't think we should derail this bill to try to drill down on how to make the assister program better when it does have protections already. And it's, to the extent it's worth the conversation, it's worth the conversation to get things better, but not to solve a problem. I don't think there's a problem in how it's being done.
But when you go into, say, where assisters are there could be signage around that emphasizes one CCO over another CCO, correct? And I think that's what part of this was trying to address.
Right. So under current statute, it is permissible to have signage in front of a site that an assister and a CCO are both doing navigation outreach. And I testified to this before, but you know, one of the reasons that this is an amendment here is that it's been provoked by a practice that we currently do. We go to homeless shelters that are all within a couple of blocks of the Care Oregon building, and because we feel like it's not acceptable to have our members sleeping on the streets in front of our building and do nothing to help them navigate, and because OHA's policy is that we can't help in re-enrollment, we set up programs in those homeless shelters that have Care Oregon brands on it, where application assisters are invited to come sign people up. Now, you might want to evaluate that practice. Maybe that's something you want to have a complaint about. Maybe that's something you want to drill into. But to the extent that that represents a competitive advantage, this is the definition of adverse selection. We're literally getting the sickest, most expensive people in Portland, and we're deliberately getting them into OHA. Now, the assisters there have training to allocate or choice counsel them evenly. And I think Care Oregon's hope is they are distributed evenly, because we want to get these folks in the Oregon Health Plan. It doesn't have to be into Care Oregon or into HealthShare, and they're the most expensive and highest risk folks we've got.
Okay. And are those the three areas?
And the fourth thing is that there's an expansion of, so the current bill says that OHA will provide training to get folks' addresses correct in the state system by allowing CCOs to update addresses and contact information. This expands that to having access to all the database information. I think you're going to find that both OHA and probably federal law will have some concerns about giving any CCO access to the entire database, including other plans' members. So right now, we can only use the database system to see our own members. This would give a CCO a viewpoint into all of the members. I'm going to let OHA speak to it, but I think that there's some risk there. My advice is to not accept the amendment and to move the bill. It came through the House with overwhelming bipartisan support. You're seeing an amendment at literally after the last hour that has work that's required, and I don't think we're trying to deflect from some of the things that are positives.
But
I wouldn't slow the bill.
Sure, there'll be another amendment, but I'd like Art to respond.
Sure, I have. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few clarifications on the fiscal. The fiscal that came out of the House on the 2838A was, quote, indeterminate. We don't really know what that means. We think there's actually a fiscal impact with the underlying bill absent the amendment. And the marketing that's currently happening in Portland is targeting the community at large, not specific folks that might be homeless or otherwise. So what we're saying is, when an application assister is providing assistance, they inform the individual of their choice, whether it be family care or health share in Portland, and Southern Oregon has overlapping service areas as well. and leave it at that. Provide them that the contact information for those CCOs, but not allow actual influence from another CCO through marketing what choices they might make after the fact. We might debate a little bit about the access to the enrollment database, but our view is that OHA can provide view-only access to only our members so that we can actually help troubleshoot the errors that have been occurring in their system. And so that is the intent of that language.
And it would be nice, I don't know if the language can change in the amendment coming up, where it would be. I mean, to me, it's logical because this is a very mobile population, and you are losing, all CCOs are losing their clients due to incorrect addresses. So that's the basis. But okay, and so if you could share, it would be nice if you could get together to come up with an amendment where both of you are agreeable to, that would be great. And it's just that I see Courtney, Morgan, biting the bit, so I got to have her come up and talk. Any other comments?
No. Thank you for having me testify in favor of this for Care Oregon, and I will give you my handout.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Morgan.
Thanks. Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee. The Dash 5 amendment that we have been working with Care Oregon on.
You need to say your name, Morgan.
Morgan Cowling with the Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing the 34 local public health departments across the state. We've been working with Care Oregon on the Dash 5 amendments, which has language that says organizations or governmental entities and is broader than my initial read of the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments looks like it defines the government entities as a city or a county, and we currently have local public health authorities that are qualified under an ORS 190, an intergovernmental agreement, are one district. So I'm not sure that the language in the Dash 6 amendment would meet the issue that we've been working with Care Oregon on. And if they both had language addressing the same issue, I don't know what would happen. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you could be sure to share, preferably directly with Art or Scott Gallant on where you can have a meeting of the minds on the A6s, I would be most happy because we are getting another amendment into the works. Okay. Any other discussion? All right. I will close the work session on House Bill 2838A, and we will... And we're going to carry over House Bill 2838A, and that's the only one we need to carry over. Is that correct? So I will see you all here on Thursday, but it won't take us long. Okay?
Or it will. Who knows?
That's true. Okay, and we're adjourned.
There's an informational tool on the Thursday.
Oh, there's an
informational tool on the Thursday.
Adjourned.